Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Mark Maselli.
And I'm Margaret Flinter.
Well, Margaret, after a brief government shutdown in Washington, we see some winners and losers in the temporary spending bill that is keeping the government running for a few more weeks. While there was no action on DACA, the Obama-era legislation aimed at accelerating citizenship for immigrants brought here illegally as children, some other children were given a reprieve. After being in limbo for months, funding for the Children's Health Insurance Program was reauthorized in the bill, and the funding will continue for the next 6 years. That's good news.
This is welcome certainty for coverage for the 9 million American kids, but also thousands of pregnant women who rely on CHIP. So on every level, Mark, I think this is a smart policy and public health decision.
Margaret, as you know, that funding had expired at the end of September, and a lot of states were deeply concerned about how they might continue to recover their vulnerable children without certainty from the federal government. So this is really good news.
As happy and relieved as we are at the CHIP funding, the nation's community health centers are still in a state of uncertainty. The health center funding also ran out, and it has not yet been reauthorized for the nation's 1,400 community health center organizations, which, as you know, care for about 24 million people across the country. Many clinics around the country tell us that they are moving to contingency plans and hiring freezes until they have some assurance about what the future is going to look like once we do have a federal budget. And that brings us to our guest today, two community health center leaders who are delivering exceptional quality care against some very daunting odds.
Naomi Fuchs is the CEO of Santa Rosa Health, a consortium of community health centers in Northern California, struck by last year's devastating wildfires. In spite of losing their primary health care clinic to fires, they are continuing to serve their patients in innovative ways, many of whom also lost their homes and their livelihood in the fires, Margaret.
And Gloria Amador will also be joining us. She runs a group of community health centers in Puerto Rico that were devastated by Hurricane Maria, which left most of the island, certainly most of their patients, without electricity, water, communications, or healthcare infrastructure. They've continued to deliver care among some amazingly challenging conditions. And not surprisingly, you may notice a little more static as telephone infrastructure hasn't been fully restored there yet. And Lori Robertson will stop by, the managing editor of factcheck.org. She is always on the hunt for misstatements spoken about health policy in the public domain.
But no matter what the topic, you can hear all of our shows by going to chcradio.com. And as always, if you have comments, please email us at chcradio@chc1.com or find us on Facebook or Twitter. We love hearing from you.
We'll get to our interview with Gloria Amador and Naomi Fuchs in just a moment.
But first, here's our producer, Marianne O'Hare, with this week's headline news.
I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines. A short-lived government shutdown has come to an end. The Senate passed a stopgap funding measure that will keep government running temporarily. But the deals are far from done. Democratic leadership agreed to end the shutdown based on assurances from Senate leader Mitch McConnell that there would be a decision on how to move forward with the Dreamers Act, DACA, which would provide a pathway to citizenship for illegal immigrants brought here as children by their parents. And one issue at hand until now had widespread bipartisan support. Funding for the nation's community health centers still hangs in limbo. And many of the nation's health centers are living on dwindling budgets with no certain path forward. Meanwhile, more states are looking at ways to recalibrate their insurance laws in the wake of changes to the Affordable Care Act. Kentucky Governor Matt Bevin's waiver allowed for work requirements for all Medicaid recipients who are able-bodied. That covers more than 250,000 Kentuckians. The state will require 20 hours a week or their benefits could be denied. The state is also considering eliminating the Medicaid expansion, which helped about 500,000 residents in that state gain coverage. And Maryland is responding to the elimination of the individual mandate that was snuck into the tax reform bill. And Maryland is concerned it will lead to lost coverage for many of its state residents. So they're considering legislation that would require all state residents to carry insurance. I'm Marianne O'Hare with these healthcare headlines.
We're speaking today with Gloria Amador, Executive Director of Salud Integral en la Montaña, also known as SIM, a private network of federally qualified health centers in Puerto Rico. Prior to that, she served as Auxiliary Director of Special Programs at the San Juan Health Department. She is continuing to provide care to tens of thousands of residents of Puerto Rico in the wake of the extreme devastation from Hurricane Maria. We're also joined today by Naomi Fuchs, CEO of Santa Rosa Community Health, a network of clinics serving the Northern California region devastated by massive wildfires. She too is continuing to deliver care to thousands of residents who were impacted by the fires, which burned thousands of homes as well as their primary care clinic. Gloria and Naomi, welcome to Conversations on Healthcare.
Thank you so much, Mark. Pleasure to be here.
Yeah, Gloria, let's start with you. In September, Puerto Rico was battered by two back-to-back hurricanes, and the second hurricane caused total devastation across the island, leaving millions of residents without power, water, food, or safe shelters. Much of the island has remained without power even today. I'm wondering what it's been like over the last 4 months. Help us better understand the scope of the devastation and the challenges that you face since then.
Well, Mark, last September, Hurricane Maria entered as a Category 5. So it was the strongest hurricane in almost a century, causing devastation and extreme damages across the island. The aftermath of Hurricane Maria reveals to us that healthcare infrastructure suffered extensive damages. Community health centers were left without electricity, with limited access to fuel for generators, lack of potable water to run the operations. Thousands of our patients have to drop essential needs, shelters, food, water, which have long-term effects on the public health. Even today, 4 months after Maria, many basic services are still not fully functioning. Maria introduced many challenges that probably will manifest over the long term, limited access to food and safe water. Also, we're seeing a lot of sanitation, disruption of services to access healthcare, medicine, and other essential health items due to medical offices shutdowns and a lot of vendors that have shut down due to the damages they receive. That have increased the infectious diseases and the endemic mosquito-borne diseases and mental health issues. Stress, depression, suicides that have increased sharply in the first months since the hurricane struck us.
It really seems almost impossible that just a few weeks later, Naomi, we're watching this record-breaking wildfire epidemic, if you will, rage across Northern California, leaving scores dead and thousands homeless and destroying so many structures. And we know that your primary care clinic, the Santa Rosa Community Health Center's Vista campus, a large primary care facility, was lost. Help us understand the impact of this devastation, Naomi, for your clinic and your community.
When 6,000 people lose their homes and 100,000 people are evacuated for days, sometimes weeks, it really is a trauma to the whole community. We care for 50,000 patients overall. Half of our patients lost their medical home, their trusted source of care, just at the time when they needed it the most. And many were evacuated into shelters or left their homes under great duress. People had minutes to escape the fires. And of course, they left without their medications, without other essential items for their health and well-being. And then in the meantime, we lost our largest facility. And 180 people worked at that facility. So they also lost their primary place of work. In those first few days, while the fires raged on, we were working in the shelters, which were really often like a mass unit. Many of the nursing homes and other very medically fragile people were evacuated into gymnasiums. And so we deployed many of our physicians off to all these shelters and our nurses and our support staff. And then we set about the business of trying to convert every usable space in our other clinics. So we had 8 other much smaller clinics that we converted into medical facilities or exam rooms in order to try to meet the needs. And we just opened our doors to whoever needed care. We just said, we'll take care of anybody that walks in and needs care. And we also, our pharmacy was tremendously helpful to replacing medications for hundreds of thousands of people.
Well, Naomi, our thoughts and prayers are also with your family and your community of service. Wondering, Gloria, if we could talk a little more about the scope of your health system, SIM, and the network of clinics you have in Puerto Rico, and maybe talk a little bit about how you're managing the continuum of care. Maybe you could share with us how that is going.
We right now operate 7 sites in the mountain region of Puerto Rico, right in the center, with 3 emergency rooms. Also, we have home care and hospice programs. CIMS serve over 55,000 patients yearly. So the disruption of the normal services have exposed weaknesses that now we cannot rely on traditional modus operations. At the beginning of the emergency, CIMS operate with limitations such as lack of electricity in all our health centers, no water, no telecommunication. But CIMS have been the first line responders during the emergency to almost all the primary health needs due to our extensive scope of service with populations. We serve homeless, HIV patients, farm workers. So due to a governmental waiver, health providers could deliver services to any patients no matter the managed care insurance plans they have. So CIMS have already starting overcome limitations. Now we're working to strengthen our infrastructure and preparing our emergency plans for future disaster, considering that every year Puerto Rico has a 6-month hurricane season. And now that is so clear the fragility of the basic utilities in the island. Finally, I must recognize that CIMS, along many volunteers, medical missions, that have been working together for all the private sector organizations, help us speed the response and recovery efforts following both hurricanes here with our community outreach project.
Well, Gloria and Naomi, I think for both of you, I would say you're conveying a really important message to people all across the country. The degree to which community health centers are such an essential part of that fabric of communities and the ability to step forward and respond in a crisis like this. And I'm also struck how similar the challenges are, regardless of where you are, when these disasters strike, when you lose the place that is the source of delivering the care. You really have to be pretty innovative pretty quickly. And Naomi, I know that one of the ways that you've innovated in Northern California, where you had so many people suddenly homeless, I understand you took a mobile clinic on the road while your main facility was out of commission. Tell us what that was like for your clinicians and your staff and their patients.
Well, we did a variety of innovative things. Our sister health centers sent us 5 mobile clinics to see the patients that lost their medical home. Most of those mobile clinics were actually co-located with some of our smaller health centers so that we could have access to things like labs and pharmacy and waiting rooms. In addition, we purchased a little-known resource, which I'm very excited to say is working out very well, called Clinics in a Can. These are converted shipping containers that arrive fully equipped as a medical exam room. And we were able to place those in the parking lot of one of our other health centers. So we bought 7 of those to add 7 exam rooms to our space. So these have been an outstanding way to respond to emergencies and to set something up very quickly. Many of the people, particularly if they were not documented, did not want to go into the community-based shelters. And so they fled to the coast during the fires, where they camped or slept out in their cars out on the coast. And we sent outreach staff and medical staff out to those encampments to make sure that people had the medical resources they needed, basically doing what we call street medicine, assuring people that if they do need medical care, that there's a place for them to go that is safe. That's some of what we did in response to the fires.
We're speaking today with 2 directors of 2 community health center organizations valiantly serving their patient population in the wake of major disasters. Gloria Amador of Salud Integral in Puerto Rico and Naomi Fuchs of Santa Rosa Community Health Center in Northern California. I'm wondering if both of you might comment on just the financial burden that has been placed on you after these tragedies. Gloria, you've been without power for 4 months. The infrastructure was destroyed. I'm wondering how you have managed in your regular daily operations of getting revenue in. And Naomi, you've lost a 50,000 square foot facility that has to be rebuilt. Some of this might be insurance, but this is an enormous lift. Naomi, let's start with you about how you're managing through this and ways that people might be able to help out.
Yes, we lost basically 50% of our income, at least in that first 6 weeks. We are looking at about a $50 million that is not going to be covered by insurance. So we are on a big fundraising drive, and you're welcome to go to our website, srhealth.org, and see what our needs are to recover. And you know, what Puerto Rico is going through in terms of the devastation of their resources is really far greater. And my heart goes out to all of you without power and electricity. We do have power back. We do have communications back. But nonetheless, we are struggling to get through this year. Most of the rebuilding, the renovation will be covered by insurance, but there's just obviously millions of dollars in lost revenue and millions of dollars in these interim facilities that we need to set up in order to continue to meet the needs of our patients. We have not received any federal funding or federal disaster relief at this point either.
And Gloria?
Yes, I must say that many generous people have been donating resources to aid our reconstruction, and still many organizations can help. Donations of the neediest articles such as flashlights, batteries, and sanitizers, hygiene products, bed sheets, towels, among others. Even monetary help will allow us to buy the neediest article to keep helping the community and keep running our operations. We have been receiving a lot of donations from FEMA and from many other organizations that have contacted us as the main first responder to the community. So those who want to help the communities in the mountains of Puerto Rico can send donations to Salud Integral en la Montaña. And then as we establish a structure to give the donations to the community, so every instance that we identify needs on specific families, we make the donations to them. So it's important for us not to only think on how we can help our own company, but how we can make our patients to be in the best capacity to them to get back to their normal lives, to get back to our health centers, to take care of their health. If they don't have any health, they don't have any life.
Well, I'd like to ask both of you to also comment on something I think has been just at the very, very top concerns we've all had. We've all been aware from the very beginning that there was another problem that was going to last long after power was restored and homes were rebuilt, and that was the impact of trauma on really large populations, children, adults, kids who've relocated up to states like ours in the Northeast, often parents staying behind in Puerto Rico. Certainly as community health centers, your centers have great behavioral health systems embedded within primary care. How has the teams in your organizations been able to respond to this trauma?
Sure. I do think that this is one of the most serious concerns on a long-term basis. We have to rebuild the homes, but if we don't give people the tools to rebuild their lives, we will have failed. And giving them the tools for emotional resiliency and recovery from this trauma is essential. So at our health center, we have an integrated behavioral health program. If a physician or nurse practitioner is talking to a patient who is expressed them, we screen them as well and ask about trauma and how they're doing emotionally. If there's an indication that they're really struggling, we do what we call a warm handoff. We call in a behavioral health person right during that visit so they don't have to wait for a follow-up appointment and transfer some of that trust to a behavioral health counselor so that we can begin to start to address their concerns. We've also greatly expanded our groups for people to be able to get support in an ongoing way for anxiety, depression, because if there's something that we have learned from other disasters is that if this is not addressed, that there is a spike in chronic disease, things like domestic violence, suicide, as well as other mental illness. We want to prevent a secondary disaster as best we can.
And Gloria, would you like to comment?
Yes, there's a lot of concerns on emotional traumas. It's been very dramatic to see a lot of heart attack, panic attack, anxiety, depression due to the devastation. And even to see it in our employees, it was worse. So the first thing after the hurricane was to manage our employees. Many of our employees lost everything, their houses, their belongings, even their kids' school clothes. So we have seen a lot of devastations among our own employees. So SIN contracted a behavioral health company to provide group sessions to all our employees. The most affected employees were sent on vacation leave to deal with their own situations, while mainly the clinical staff were deployed to emergency rooms and psychologists and clinicians through the low demand of services at the CAC due to the block access to get to the health center. Then we start bringing an at the health center to manage our patients while making them need assessments of their damages to provide them donations. Even in the community clinics, a lot of patients ask for mental and behavioral health aid, because they don't know how to manage that. So a lot of people who were in critical economic conditions now have other determinants on health affecting their lives. So bringing other organizations like universities that provide behavioral health classes or students so they can help us during the process of helping our patients.
You know, you both are funded by HRSA, and I was thinking about what we go through in a normal preparation and making sure our emergency preparedness plan is set and in place. And I'm wondering what your advice is. How well did the plan work for you? Do you have some advice for other healthcare providers? But what are your thoughts about preparation as people think about it, preparing for future emergencies?
I have to admit, I was definitely one of those people that had the binder on the shelf and never really paid that much attention to it before. And now I'm meeting regularly with our safety officer and reviewing our updated plan on a regular basis. There were two things that I would point out the most. One is making sure people are trained in their various roles, that you really define the roles and responsibilities clearly. A major disaster means everybody's doing a new job. You want to make sure that the right people are doing those jobs. Logistics, you know, where are people going to be? Where are patients going to be? How are you going to get supplies from one place to another? Staff deployments, knowing that your staff is safe. Where are they? Who can come in and who can't come in, which changed hourly. I mean, we would have a set of staff on site taking care of patients, and, you know, there'd be an alert and 20 people would have to leave because their homes were being evacuated. So to be able to be absolutely nimble is really the second. So role clarification is critical, and it's sometimes hour by hour. Communication across all your staff. I mean, we have 500 employees. Finding ways to reach people when the normal communication systems are down, all those kinds of things became critical. So while you do your very best to plan, just know that you also have to have plan B and plan C when those people aren't available, that ability to be flexible. In those first 4 days, the fire, most extreme time, we had all hands meetings by phone or in person, depending on where people would be. It went to the speed of the decisions that had to be made and the changes that were going on. So communication was a number one priority, whether it was the wind changing, the smoke in different facilities, all of those kinds of things. I also want to just go back to something Gloria said about staff. I'm so glad you brought it up, because not only did our staff lose homes, 20 of our employees lost their homes, 150 of them were evacuated, they are also hearing the stories of everybody else's pain and suffering as they come through the door and experiencing the vicarious trauma on top of their own trauma. So having resources available, having groups, having all kinds of ways to help people manage their stress and their trauma. Our staff can't take care of other people unless they're taking care of themselves as well.
Great. And Gloria, lessons learned?
I have to say that we hear there's a hurricane coming. Every week we hear something's coming. So sometimes people lay back and do not take care of that. In our case, we prepare our health centers 3 days before. We make all the preparations we have in our binder, but nobody expected to get the devastations we had during this hurricane. Nobody was prepared. The government was not prepared. Even we that have emergency rooms and we're the ones supposed to be prepared, we have employees there for 5 days because we cannot get to them because there was no way to get to those health centers. The roads were blocked. We lose all kind of telecommunications. Even we have satellite phones. We have cell phones. There was no communications, at least for the first week. So it was very difficult. We just were waiting there for people to show up, for employees to know a little about when they're going to be available to come, deciding where we're going to leave the people. Are we going to be in the main office where no patients are coming, or so we moved to one of our health centers so we can be with the people and with the employees over there. We visit all our health centers. We visit our community. We sat down with the emergency offices, with the policemen. After the hurricane, we went to the governmental emergency office. So we get all the information from FEMA, from electricity, power, from the utility companies, from the telephone companies. So we can tell our patients and our employees where we have to start first. Even we have to establish runners to come from each health center every day to bring all the information from the health center. We have a lot of issues with diesel here. We have to get our own truck with diesel. So even we never thought that we will need that. Now we understand that we really need that. So you will never be prepared for what happened during the hurricane, but now we are waiting to face another Category 5 hurricanes in the future, preparing ourselves, making all our emergency plans, and how Naomi said, preparing our employees, training them, making sure that we can get to know where our employees live. So if we have to go to them, we know how to get them, and understanding that we are human beings. We have our own needs, that to serve the people, we need to be to comply with our first needs at our families and our home so we can go back to our working place. So even if it's difficult for us to prepare for a magnitude of hurricane with that magnitude, we will have to do it every year. So we're prepared to keep serving the community.
We've been speaking today with Gloria Amador, Executive Director of Salud Integral a la Montaña, a network of community health centers in Puerto Rico. You can follow their work by going to simpr.org or follow them on Twitter at @simpuertorico. We've also been speaking with Naomi Fuchs, CEO of Santa Rosa Community Health Center. You can follow their work at srhealth.org or on their Facebook page, Santa Rosa Community Health. Naomi and Gloria, thank you so much for your incredible leadership, for setting such an example in your communities with the work that you do, and for joining us on Conversations on Healthcare today. And to our listeners, if you've been moved as we are by this story of incredible resilience and recovery, it's a long slog. We encourage you to go to their websites and consider a donation. Thank you both.
Bye-bye. Bye-bye.
At Conversations on Healthcare, we want our audience to be truly in the know when it comes to the facts about healthcare reform and policy. Lori Robertson is an award-winning journalist and managing editor of FactCheck.org, a nonpartisan, nonprofit consumer advocate for voters that aim to reduce the level of deception in U.S. politics. Lori, what have you got for us this week?
President Donald Trump has been in office for a year, and we've now published our first story on Trump's numbers, a look at statistical indicators under his presidency. Just as we did for former President Barack Obama, we will publish quarterly updates to this series. One measure we examine is the number of people without health insurance. Under Trump's presidency so far, that number has gone up. The most recent report from the National Health Interview Survey estimates that during the first 6 months of 2017, 28.8 million people were uninsured. That's an increase of only 200,000 from 2016, and it's still 19.8 million fewer than were uninsured in 2010, the year Obama signed the Affordable Care Act into law. But the latest National Health Interview Survey only includes figures for the first half of last year. More recent polling by the Gallup organization covered the last 3 months of 2017 and found a much larger increase in the uninsured. It estimated that 3.2 million Americans entered the ranks of the uninsured last year. Gallup's polling is based on interviews with 25,000 adults. Trump failed to repeal and replace Obama's Affordable Care Act as he promised to do, but the tax bill he signed into law in December will end in 2019 Obamacare's tax penalty for people who fail to obtain coverage. Repealing the mandate will increase the number of uninsured by millions, according to the nonpartisan Congressional Budget Office. CBO estimated that ending the mandate will cause 4 million people to lose or drop coverage in 2019, rising to 13 million by 2025. CBO said that ending the mandate would cause policy premiums for those buying individual policies to rise 10% in most years. Quote, healthier people would be less likely to obtain insurance, CBO said, and the subsequent hike in premiums would then cause others not to buy coverage. And that's my Fact Check for this week. I'm Lori Robertson, Managing Editor of FactCheck.org.
FactCheck.org is committed to factual accuracy from the country's major political players and is a project of the Annenberg Public Policy Center at the University of Pennsylvania. If you have a fact that you'd like checked, email us at chcradio.com. We'll have FactCheck.org's Lori Robertson check it out for you here on Conversations on Healthcare. This is Conversations on Healthcare. I'm Margaret Flinter.
And I'm Mark Maselli. Peace and health.
Conversations on Healthcare, broadcast from WESU at Wesleyan University, streaming live at WESUFM.org, and brought to you by the Community Health Center.